Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back with the number 89 movie in our favorite 100 movies of all time. That's right. We're on episode number 12. Anybody actually think we were going to get here when we set out to start this thing? I bet you all thought we were going to disappear after three or four episodes, like most people do. Once the views don't start coming in the thousands, everybody runs away. But we're not running away. We're here. And this is going to be an interesting episode. We're going to break John's rule, and then we're going to talk about a musical, which I actually meant to look this up beforehand, and I should know this because it's my own damn list, but I believe is my highest ranked musical of all time. We're talking Cabaret and Fight Club tonight, John. John, how you feeling about tonight's episode?
I'm really excited about tonight's episode. Both of these movies are really fun to talk about, especially because of the themes in the movies aren't as obvious on an initial watch of them. So it's going to be really fun diving into them.
Yeah, and I'm looking. I just went down my list. This is my highest ranked musical. So, John, I don't know if you have musicals ranked higher or what we would classify as a musical, but this is my highest ranked one.
Well, I have Beauty and the Beast at like 29 or something.
Is that a musical or is that animated? We can't cross contaminate here.
There's a stage version of it. It's definitely a musical.
Yes, no, that's a good point. All right, well, yeah, so animated. Well, I have WALL-E, okay? Same thing, musical or something. No, it's not. But anyway, so yeah, this is my highest ranked musical. John, we're talking Fight Club. Two movies that are very unique in their style, that is for sure. And we're going to start off tonight for sure with Cabaret, because in terms of popularity, I don't think there's any denying that Cabaret is the less popular of these two. I will go as far as to say that Fight Club could be the most overrated movie of all time, and it's still great. It's still great, but it's just hit that point of too popular for its own good, because like the fans of it are like top 10 movie of all time. And it's like, okay, probably not, but you have that. But we're going to be talking about Cabaret, the movie that very nearly won Best Picture over The Godfather. Just want everybody to know that, because keep in mind, everybody, Citizen Kane didn't win Best Picture over How Green Was My Valley. How Green Was My Valley ended up winning. And How Green Was My Valley, nobody ever talks about. Citizen Kane normally ranked as number one movie of all time. The Godfather also almost lost Best Picture, which is something to think about. But this one, Bob Fosse does win Best Director over Francis Ford Coppola. John, was this your first time watching the movie, but you'd seen a stage play before.
That's right. And there are several differences between the two that I'll get into a little bit later. But yeah, it was the first time watching it. I think this is also our first AFI Top 100 movie we're discussing on the podcast, is it not?
Is it? Hang on. I got to look real quick now. You got this in my head. No, Toy Story is an AFI Top 100 movie. Right. So Toy Story was, and that is the only one. So yes, this is the second. Oh, no. And I talked about The Wizard of Oz. So this is actually the third AFI Top 100 movie that we're talking about. And so... Like here, Jordan Alford says, Cabaret is 9 out of 10. It's just The Godfather is just a 100 out of 10. Cabaret is one of those movies that sneaks up on me. So I'll give my spiel, considering it's my number 89, and then we'll get into full-blown discussion here. But Cabaret was a movie. So my dad is heavily Italian. I know I don't look it, but I am very Sicilian. It doesn't make sense, but my dad is Sicilian. So, you know, The Godfather is one of those movies where it's like, yes, that's what it was like. I'm like, you weren't in the mob. What is wrong with it? Like, that's not what it was like. You didn't grow up in the 40s. You didn't work for an olive oil company. You weren't in the mob. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this isn't what it was like. But he just loves that Italian family kind of camaraderie thing. So his least favorite person to ever grace this earth is Joel Grey. Joel Grey is a monster to him. He knocked off Robert Duvall, Al Pacino, and James Caan for Best Supporting Actor in 1972. Now, that's Sonny Corleone, Michael Corleone, and Tom Hagen. Three really iconic characters. And my dad does not like that. So Joel Grey sucked. Every time when I was growing up, it was Joel Grey sucks, Joel Grey sucks, Joel Grey sucks. So I sat down and I watched Cabaret because I was trying to go through all of AFI's top 100. And it was one of the ones I hadn't seen. And that was one that I wasn't going to watch with my dad. So I watched it alone. I watched it. And I was like, ooh, Joel Grey does not suck. Joel Grey is very good in this movie. Now, is he Michael Corleone level? Probably not. But Joel Grey is very, very good in this movie. Should he have won? James Caan or Al Pacino should have won. But then on my most recent viewing of The Godfather, I actually found Robert Duvall to be the best actor in the movie. And so I understand why there was some split vote going on here. But I have to say, in defense of Joel Grey, you did deserve to win something. You just came out in the wrong year, my friend, because this performance that he gives in this movie is so haunting, and he does almost nothing. But that's my pitch about Cabaret. This is my third time watching it. I'm not a huge musical fan, but to me, this movie is just powerful on so many different levels.
Yeah, I agree. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that you have Bob Fosse directing it. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, Bob Fosse is an iconic choreographer and dancer. And you can see that throughout the entire film, not just in the Cabaret segments, but also in his blocking in scenes. Mm-hmm. It's very clear while watching this movie that Bob Fosse understands movement. Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't seen a Bob Fosse movie, check one out. All That Jazz is probably the next most popular movie, called Star 80, about a Playboy model starring Eric Roberts. Wild movie. Wild, wild movie. A little dated because it's 80s, but a really good murder mystery type movie. Not really murder mystery, but like noir-ish movie. But Jordan Alford just said it, and John, I'm going to talk about it right now. We're starting with this because Jordan Alford said, when the Nazi guy sings, it's so haunting and disturbing. And you're talking about Bob Fosse. So I say this all the time, and I speak in hyperbole a lot. I can't help myself. I'm talking about my 100 favorite movies. Every movie is going to have a scene where I go, best scene ever, or it's going to have an actor where I say one of the best performances or best direction. This scene is so unbelievably haunting when he is singing Tomorrow Belongs to Me, because Bob Fosse does a brilliant, and this is something that I love about this movie, and you'll start to see come up a lot. They don't know what the Nazis are really going to become. They know the Nazis aren't a good thing, but at the same time, you look at American politics right now, you have people who argue one side is Nazis, you have the other side who argues that side is Nazis. Both sides are doing it and saying, no, they're bad, they're bad, they're bad. The thing was, there was nothing to compare this to and this movie takes place in 1931 when this was happening. And so it was the buildup to it. And it was, oh, they're taking down the communists and then they'll disappear. But then it started to become more than that. And for him to show this beautiful looking man, this blonde hair, blue eyed, beautiful looking man with an angelic voice, just singing this song where with the stag and all of the running free and the lyrics to this song. I mean, it's bad because I want to listen to this all the time in my car. And then I remember that it's kind of a fake Nazi anthem and I shouldn't do that. But it's such a beautifully written song. And all he does is slowly, slowly pan down to that swastika on his arm. And it's so brilliantly filmed because you're seeing other people and their reaction. Oh, they look like they're going to cry. And it's so much. And then it just gets to that spot. And you're like, this is a Nazi saying. And by the end of it, everybody's rousing because people forget the Nazis were popular. That's how they came into power. And that's the thing throughout human history, unless it's a king or something like that. Normally, it's kind of the people who support it at first, and then it starts to fall apart. And for this scene to see everybody there singing this really powerful, well-written, nicely worded song, but know that this is being sung by a Nazi and they're going to commit some of the most heinous crimes in the history of the world. Oof. It's just, it's so beautifully done. And it's just, it's an unbelievable scene. And it really does go down to me as just one of the finest pieces of filmmaking ever. I won't say one of the best because I say that too much, but one of the finest pieces of filmmaking of all time.
And this is, if I'm remembering the stage play correctly, this is the moment where we get the intermission for the musical.
Oh, okay.
So this, and it's kind of obvious when you're watching the movie too, because this marks a drastic change in the film.
Yeah.
Before this, we're more looking at like sexuality and jealousy as themes, and then all of a sudden it's like, no, Nazis are here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the entire third act of this movie is all about the rise of Nazis and how it's infecting everything, including the Kit Kat Club.
Yep, exactly. And One of the great choices here too is how it opens with that shot of the mirror, and then Joel Grey comes in, and it ends with the shot of the mirror, but the Nazis are there now, and it's their presence has just started to infiltrate every little thing. And you hear it in the dialogue where they're talking about the Jews, and oh well, you know, they do have this network of banks and things like that. And what's fascinating to me about a movie like this, this is so hard to do. And I have Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on my list. Everybody Wants Some is on my list. Now, obviously, Everybody Wants Some isn't building up to nearly as big of a moment as Cabaret or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But these movies that are about what happens before, from here to eternity, it's about before the Pearl Harbor attack. You don't know that you're about to be a part of a massive piece of history. On March 10th of 2020, we didn't know that the whole world was going to shut down because of COVID. We didn't know. We knew things were happening, but we didn't know to the extreme of what was going to happen. Even go back earlier when people started hearing about it in November, December, nobody knew what was really going to happen. And to take on something like the Nazis, which, you know, this is something that even in 1972 had been done a lot. The Nazis were already, you know, that was something that was already starting to be come up in film. It's something that obviously is the bad guy. It's a villain in so many different things, but to make it about what happened before they came to power. And these people are living their lives with what they think is so important. You have the guy who's trying to be a gold digger and marry up. And you have Liza Minnelli, who just wants to be an actress. And you have I always call him Basil Exposition because that's who he is in Austin Powers. But you have Michael York, who just wants to kind of get his degree and move on with his life. Mm-hmm. And they don't know and they don't realize what they're actually living through and the massiveness of all of this. And to be able to pull off a movie like that and make it so powerful, just as powerful as if you were to make the movie set in that time period, it's so hard to do. And one of my favorite things about Cabaret.
And that's one of the most beautiful things about Cabaret too, is because everyone knows who the Nazis are. Mm-hmm. An audience member will always know, oh, this is bad. This is leading to something very, very bad. There is something bad on the horizon. It's coming. I know what it is. Oh my God, guys, get out of there. Mm-hmm. But that builds the tension as we get into, again, that third act, where it is about the Nazi rise to power. And it is about the danger that these characters we've been introduced to throughout the movie are in because of that rise to power.
Yeah. Yeah, and you think about, you know, some of these early songs, like you were saying, Mein Herr, great song, so catchy, unbelievable. You have the when they start getting into the sexuality and they're talking about, what is it, two women or two whatever it is, when the Baron comes in, the Money Makes the World Go Round song, which I honestly think what Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey do in that scene is just so unbelievable. When they're singing just after each other, one of the coolest moments in ever. I just love that scene. It's so ridiculous. But yeah, it's just all of these things. And then all of a sudden you get to the part where he's dancing with the monkey. And oh, if you could see her through my eyes, she wouldn't, you know, oh, if you could see her through my, and the whole song. And then at the very end, he goes, she wouldn't look Jewish at all. And you're just like, wow, because that's what it has turned into. And you think about it, like, you know, this is something people also, I think, start to fail to realize sometimes when it comes to politics or just in general what's going on. Everybody thinks what they're living in is the right thing. That's why it happens, because people think what people are thinking. Very rarely are people thinking, oh, this isn't correct. I'm going to follow this movement because it's wrong. And that's not how it goes. Very often, a lot of these things start off with the best intentions and then just go south because they're not actually good. They're not good things to be happening. And so when you're thinking about this, think about the comedians nowadays, or people on Twitter, or people on social media of any kind, and whatever they're doing, whatever political take you're saying out there, you need to know that in 10 years, that might not necessarily be as positive in 10 years as you think it is now. And all of the comedians who changed their style to take their shots at this person, or to take their shots at, when Obama's president, they take their shots at them. When Trump's president, they take their shots here. Now that Biden's president, they take their shots here. As the society is telling you to change. And I think Cabaret does a really good job of showing that, where this little club, this Kit Kat club, this little thing, it's starting to, even though at the beginning they all hate this idea and they hate this concept, and Michael York is very anti-Nazi movement, and so is Liza Minnelli, even though she's not nearly as vocal about it, But while all of that is going on, the Kit Kat Club is still going to go with what the popular belief is at the time, because that's ultimately going to bring in their money and that's going to do what's best for them. It's just, there's so many commentaries on just life in general. And the fact that we never see Joel Grey outside of the cabaret is another really great decision, which I'm sure was, that was the same thing in the play, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, this is kind of where we get into some of the differences in the play and the film, because the Master of Ceremonies is always in the cabaret, and his character's so interesting when it comes to the use for a musical, because generally with a musical, you have the characters bursting into song to kind of progress the plot. Mm-hmm. Whereas in cabaret, you have the songs happening that are explaining further in further detail the themes of the scenes that preceded them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting storytelling technique to reinforce these themes so that the audience is picking up on it no matter what.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the scene before, sometimes it then leads into stuff that's happening later. I mean, it's all over. But I do think what I like so much about Cabaret, and clearly I'm not a big musical fan if this is my highest rated one and it's at number 89, but one of the things that I love about Cabaret is that all of the songs are rooted in realism. Mm-hmm. And one of my big things when it comes to musicals like West Side Story or Sound of Music, which are great movies, there's no doubt about it, but I'm not a big fan of, I'm just going to start singing now. It's time for me to break out in a song, and you know the words, right, kids? All right, let's go and sing. Like, okay. To me, that doesn't work because I'm just not into that style. I understand why that works, but I'm not into those types of moments. I love La La Land. That one almost made my list. I know that's maybe an unpopular opinion. I don't care. But I love that movie. And why I like that movie so much, I think, is because there's some great musical numbers, but there's also about an hour of that movie where there's nothing. It's just a relationship movie for like an hour. And being somebody who lived in LA, I could relate pretty heavily to what they were going through in that hour of the movie. So, but what I love about Cabaret is that they're never breaking down the fact that they shouldn't know. You know what I mean? They always know what they're singing because it's part of the show. And when that guy gets up, the Nazi gets up and he's singing at the beer garden, he knows that song and he's going to get everybody into it. And clearly they all know the song because it's some sort of anthem or something like that. So I just think that there's so many interesting elements to a movie that's very rooted in realism, but is still a musical at the end of the day.
Yeah, and that's one of the beauties of musicals sometimes, is that they do kind of get this nice realism aspect to them. And it is what separates Cabaret from a lot of musicals. Mm-hmm. Because there is a specific place where the songs take place where it makes sense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have that musical effect where everyone kind of just like gets in on it all together and is all of a sudden singing the same song despite not interacting with each other at beforehand.
Yeah. In the Heights is coming out. Yeah. I mean, that's the Lin-Manuel Miranda movie that's coming out. And like, to me, like that, sure, the songs are going to be catchy and I'm probably going to get it in my head, but that's not the type of movie that I run out and see. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's just not it. I just like this style. I just think that this kind of style is more of my style, because it's like, they're not just singing to sing. They're singing because this is what their livelihoods are, and this is what they're trying to do. And Liza Minnelli gives an absolutely fantastic performance, and I like the hairstyle choices and things that they make with her to make her not be all that attractive, because she's going to be a star one day. That's what she wants to be. And obviously she's got all the talent in the world, but how is she going to be a star? You know, like, that's the kind of questions that you're being left with. And I think, you know, keeping it rooted in what it's rooted in, I think it works on so many levels.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, Liza Minnelli's character is one of the changes from the stage play.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm curious to hear this.
And it comes down to nationality.
Okay.
The nationalities are reversed. Liza Minnelli's character so Susie Bowles is British in the stage play. And then, blanking on the name right now.
No, I just keep calling him Michael York because I can't think of his name either.
Yeah. So Michael York's character is actually American. In the stage play. Doesn't change a lot of it, but there are some connotations to it that change.
I kind of like the way it is, mainly because the American way is the whole movie way. And if you want to be a big shining star, it's like, go to America and everything will work out fine. Because, yeah, that's totally what happens down here. But come on down and everything's going to be great. And I think that, you know, if that's kind of from the British point of view, it might not have the same kind of tone, especially at this time when silent movies were turning into sound movies and you were starting to get your stars. Clark Gable was starting to become a person and you were starting to get your, you know, you were past the days of Rudolph Valentino and you were into the days of, ooh, who's that person? You know, who's Claude Colbert? You know, like that's what you're starting to get around this time. So it makes sense that she, you know, that being an American, she wants that Hollywood dream, which is starting to start take shape for people.
Yeah, exactly. It just seems weird that the American would go abroad to try to pursue that. To me.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I almost wonder if they, I think in the movie they do a good job of making her seem like just a really desperate person with a terrible relationship with her father. And why would she go to Germany? Because it's kind of this thing of if people can't make it somewhere, oh, I'm going to move here. But are you going to make it there or are you still in the same boat that you were? And I think like for her, maybe it's like, well, I'll just go to Germany and I'll make it, you know, something like that. But who knows why she's there? Maybe it has something to do with the war, the First World War. And then she just ended up there. And that's why her relationship with her father's bad. Like, we don't really get much of her backstory, but I feel like we get enough to know that she's clearly suffering from something. There's something, there's a big piece of her that's missing and that she needs to fill some way.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And one of the other differences is our side characters aren't in the musical at all.
Real, so they definitely went a little bit further in with the whole Jewish people living in Nazi Germany.
It's just different characters doing kind of the same thing.
Okay.
So, what is it? Fraulein Schneider, the proprietor of the hostel, is actually essentially Fritz's character.
Okay.
So, like, that's gender swapped for
got it
for the movie.
Got it. Yeah. So like things that, but ultimately I think things that maybe they, I haven't seen the play, but things that might make this work because Fritz being the desperate guy going after this woman who's out of his league. I mean, that kind of seems to be more of like the 30s type thing. And then you get Liza Minnelli just pounce, you know, like I think those types of things work for sure. Yeah. And I like the relationship between Fritz and Fraulein Schneider because I like how this one builds. And at the end, when he just walks up, he's like, I'm a Jew. Like, and it just cuts to them getting married. Like it's those little things that really work. And then, the Baron is just an interesting character to me because it's just all that money and everything that you could think that you want. And then you realize like, he's just got his own little issues or his own problems and things that he can't take care of that the money just can't fix sometimes, or that the money can't help, you know, some of these things. So,
yeah, but we also get that incredible scene of screw Max. I already am. Yeah. I am.
Yep. I know. Was this one of the first times that like a three-way involving also a gay relationship was portrayed in film, in Hollywood film?
I would have to do a lot of research to find out otherwise, but it's very possible.
At least in a way of mainstream, you would think that it has to be one of the first times that we were seeing something like this, because definitely wasn't in the 40s or 50s, not in a mainstream sense. And in the 60s, I doubt it. I mean, everybody always says Lawrence of Arabia was gay, but it's like, okay, but he didn't do anything. Like there's not even a woman in that movie, and then you don't see him ever doing anything with men. So it's like, this might be one of the first times. I mean, that one scene where they're all about, it looks like they're about to kiss and the music just changes and they back away. Like that was very progressive for 1972 to have something like, I mean, then you get like something like The Dreamers in the late 90s, early 2000s, the Bertolucci movie, but you know, this was very progressive.
Mm-hmm. And that scene that you're talking about there, where they're dancing together and it just looks like they're all about to kiss at the same time, really does play into that jealousy theme that I mentioned earlier. Because you think it's Michael York's character being jealous of Max and taking away the attention of Susie, especially because it was prefaced earlier in the movie that, you know, when friends start having sex, things get messy. And then we find out that the jealousy kind of extends further than that because it's also him involved with Max as well.
Yeah. And Max is just like, I have money. Who cares? I'm going to go back to my wife after all this. Like it just, it doesn't matter for him. Yeah, there's that's interesting with the jealousy and things like that. So, yeah, I like the way all the side characters and the main characters work together in these movies. Mm-hmm. I think that it just they are all doing their part, and the acting in this is phenomenal. And this was at a time when I think acting started to get better around this time. I feel like there's some great acting, don't get me wrong, in the 50s and the 60s and stuff like that. But, you know, Planet of the Apes, one of my favorite movies of all time. We're going to be talking about that a long time from now. Charlton Heston couldn't act worth a lick. But, you know, we're starting to get into that more realistic type acting, and how can we make it as realistic as possible? And so one thing I was thinking about when I watched it this time, I feel, and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that Cabaret is one of the most underappreciated musical films ever made. Because when a musical film does come up, people always go to Sound of Music, Wizard of Oz, you know, West Side Story, you know, Jordan Alford's in here with American in Paris, you know, those types of Singing in the Rain, these types of movies. And my reasoning that I think this happens is because musicals are a very family oriented genre. Mm-hmm. And this movie is so far away from being family oriented. The thing about when you watch The Wizard of Oz the first time, you're probably 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years, something like that.
Yeah.
Easy, maybe even younger. When you sit down and you watch West Side Story, you're not really noticing that this is about, you know, coming like racism in America and prejudice in America and all that. You're just watching a movie with catchy songs.
Yeah.
Just catchy songs. And even I Want to Live in America, you don't understand what that means as a kid, but you like it. Sound of Music, you don't really realize that they're escaping also from the Nazis. Like, you don't realize that. But this movie is an adult movie. And adults, especially people like us, like or men, they don't really necessarily seek out musicals once they hit a certain point. I can't sit down with my friend and be like, hey, man, you want to watch this musical? It's pretty cool. Like that doesn't happen often unless you're musical theater kind of people. For me to get like my friend who we just watched a sporting event and then say, hey, you want to watch this musical? It's not going to happen. But I think that's made this movie become very underappreciated and very underseen just because people don't go out of their way to seek this sort of movie out anymore and or as often. And because it's not one that they grow up with, they don't necessarily have that attachment to it when they go back and look at it in the past.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously, I am the type of person who does go seek out musicals because I do have a musical theater background and everything. And most of the best musicals are more adult-oriented rather than the family-friendly ones. They just don't get movies most of the time. But even if we look at it, when these musicals do come out, these more adult-oriented ones, they're also almost always considered for Oscars.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we had another Bob Fosse musical with Chicago in 2002.
But that was directed by Rob Marshall, right?
Yeah, but Bob Fosse did the original choreography for it.
I was going to say, do you think that Rob Marshall was inspired by Bob Fosse at all when he directed that movie?
Yes, quite a lot.
Just a little, un poco.
but Chicago is kind of like that more modern example of what Cabaret is, because people don't even talk about Chicago anymore, despite it winning Best Picture.
Yeah. Well, that's because Chicago is a lot more polarizing, I feel, too. Because Chicago, you have to think, too, when a musical wins Best Picture, it's got to win against nothing, because if it wins against anything, you think about a movie like Oliver that beats Space Odyssey. Well, now Oliver is going to be hated forever. When My Fair Lady beats Doctor Strangelove, well, now My Fair Lady is going to be hated forever. And then you get a movie like Chicago, which beats The Hours and Two Towers, and Adaptation wasn't even nominated for Best Picture, and The Pianist. People are always going to look down on it a little bit more. And I haven't seen Chicago in years. I actually need to rewatch Chicago because I don't have a good feel for what it was. I remember I watched it probably when I was like 11 or 12 and didn't really like it. But then again, I was 11 or 12. And there was a lot of things I didn't like when I was 11 or 12. So
And that's just kind of what I'm saying, is that these movies kind of fall out of the wayside because of that. And Cabaret did the exact same thing. We were just talking about it. It came out the same year as The Godfather.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it literally one of the greatest films ever made came out the same year. So in retrospect, you don't have people going back and saying, yeah, Cabaret, one of the greatest films ever made. Like, yeah, it's on the AFI top 100, but a lot of people don't look at that list, and they don't when they're going back for movie recommendations. And movie recommendations are more based on what's passed down to you from our parents and the people in our lives. So if you have parents who are more inclined to be like, hey, watch Godfather, than watching Cabaret, you are going to miss it. And it's unfortunate because there is just that aversion for musical theater that a lot of people have, and they miss some great films because of it.
They do. They do. And I think it's because parents are either the comedy parent or they're the drama parent. My dad always loved best picture type movies and those types of things, The Godfather. And, you know, then he liked horror with Psycho and things along those lines. But it's looking at that. Then you get a comedy, people who love Adam Sandler and things like that, you know, or Belushi, and they start going down that line. Very rarely do you get the parents who are like, let's sit down and watch, unless it is The Wizard of Oz or something. I didn't watch Singing in the Rain until I was in high school because that wasn't a movie. Even though my dad would love looking at the top, you know, the AFI Top 100, it would just be, oh, I can't believe Singing in the Rain's at number five. Have you seen it? No, but I can't believe it's there because how could it be ahead of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? It doesn't make sense. How could it be above The Graduate? Like, it's just like you said, that aversion. And, you know, we got to move on to Fight Club, but I just want to say again, the acting in this movie is phenomenal. Liza Minnelli earns her Oscar. She is fantastic. Bob Fosse's direction is impeccable. Francis Ford Coppola's is better, but Bob Fosse's is impeccable. I mean, it's unfortunate that Bob Fosse's going up against Francis Ford Coppola this year. He ends up winning Best Director and nobody ever talks about it. But the one interesting thing is that because it didn't win Best Picture, this is actually a good thing because then it doesn't come up on every list as the worst movie to win Best Picture, because it's not. And that's something that we'll talk about when we get to other movies that I have on this list, like Crash and Shakespeare in Love and things like that, where they're not bad movies. They just beat good movies and people then start to hate them. How Green Was My Valley? From what I hear, because I haven't actually seen it, but that's a very well-received movie. It's just everybody now wants to hate on it because it beat Citizen Kane. But all of that being said, what they do with Joel Grey's character in this movie, even though he shouldn't have beaten those three guys, one of them should have won it for sure. What they do with Joel Grey's character to make him demonic and to make him the way he is, and how he really, we don't know anything about him except that he can sing and dance and wears a lot of makeup and he's creepy looking and he's always kind of there. And he's just kind of, it's like he knows he is the devil. He's playing that role of, ha, I know what's going to get you guys. It's going to be money, or it's going to be threesomes, or it's going to be what, you know, whatever. Oh, you're going to marry a Jew. Like, you know, that's, you know, unfortunately kind of seen as the equivalent in this time period.
Yeah.
And when you start to look at that, the way they do his makeup and his performance and his facial expressions, I love that we get no backstory on him. I love that all we get is him like sticking his tongue out and singing and saying, welcome to the cabaret. And then Alvita saying goodbye. That's it. It's so interesting. And characters like that can sometimes be more haunting than characters with a very deep backstory. And that's my last pitch on that. I love Joel Grey's performance in this movie. And he shouldn't have won, but I freaking love his performance. And I think his character is one of the most fascinating characters in film history, just because of how little we get, but how powerful the expressions are. So I also, and this will be my last thing, I also tell my dad that Joel Grey deserved to win because it made his career go on to be massive. And then my dad gets mad. He's like, look at what Al Pacino did and James Caan did and Robert Duvall. And I'm like, well, yeah, Joel Grey, this was really the only movie he was in. Everything else was stage plays. He knew what he was going to do, but he had his one moment and he came in and he ruined a lot of Godfather fans' mentalities, clearly, as I'm seeing here. But if you haven't watched Oz, check out Oz. Joel Grey comes up in season 5 or 6. He shows up late in that show, and it's interesting to see Joel Grey in something else. All right, let's jump in here now to Fight Club. And Jordan Oliver says, Crash was well-intentioned but poorly thought out. I have so much to say about that. But we're talking about Fight Club, John's 89th best movie, and I think it's ranked like number 11 or 10 or something like that on IMDb or something. Maybe not quite that good.
Ridiculously high.
But John, why is it your favorite? Why is it your 89th favorite movie of all time?
Well, I mean, let's preface Fight Club the way all of us do in high school when we finally find out about Fight Club. Some bro comes up to you in one of your classes. You've never talked to this person before, and they're trying to connect to you somehow. And they're like, hey, have you seen Fight Club? Like, no. And then you go watch Fight Club, and you're like, why do you like this movie? This movie is insulting your type of person. Because this movie is phenomenal for everything it is critiquing. Mm-hmm. It is the greatest thing about this movie is the fact that it goes over the heads of so many people who watch it because they do not understand this is a satire.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so watching it this time, and I'd seen it numerous times, but I hadn't seen it in a while. And because some of the reason why I don't watch it all that often is because I do feel like the hype sometimes it just drives me nuts. And then if I sit down and watch it with somebody who likes it too much, it kind of annoys me. I'm like, oh my God, like it's not that, you know, same thing with The Dark Knight, which was on my list, but I feel sometimes people just go a little overboard with it. And they, you know, like I said, the worst thing that we got out of The Dark Knight is that people walked around being like, hey, I'm going to do the Joker voice. And it's like, stop. And I think it's the same thing with this. All of a sudden, everybody was, don't talk about Fight Club. It's like, oh, you're the one, huh? You're that clever. Interesting. Yeah. But Chuck Palahniuk, I can never say his last name, but something like
Palahniuk. I looked it up today.
Palahniuk.
It's Palahniuk.
So like Palahniuk. I like that.
Like the name Paula, then Nick.
Palahniuk. Okay. Yeah. So Chuck Palahniuk is so good with satire. And when he's on his A game, there's nobody better. Invisible Monsters, Fight Club, Haunted. We go on and on. Survivor, great book. He's really on his A game when he has these things. And Fight Club was just the most accessible, even though it's accessible for the reasons that he's saying, you idiots, this is what you're going to find accessible, which is violence. And
yeah,
it's perfect satire. It really
is. It is because at its root, the most obvious thing is that it's a stance against consumerism, which it is. It is very much saying, hey, the things we own don't own us. And a lot of the things that Tyler Durden says throughout this movie is part of the message that the movie and the original novel is trying to get across. But it's also trying to say, but toxic masculinity is not the response to that.
No.
And just the fact that there's an animal instinct within these people to be like, yes, fighting is the best way to get through absolutely anything in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It'll make everything better. All we need to do is beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah. And what, you know, what this movie's all about is, oh, we're not owned by the things that we own and all of that. And our apartment and, you know, the Brad Pitt crash in the car scene where he's like, just let go. Who cares? And what is Tyler Durden doing? He's franchising the entire movie. He's franchising all around him. Oh, and now we have one here and we have one here and we have one here and we have one here. And it's how even when you're trying to be against, some, you know, I always think about this, like all these people who are I can't even think of the word, but, you know, they're counterculture. That's it. I'm this, I'm that. And then it's like, okay, but you're also making $1 million being canceled counterculture because you're hearing you've made such a name for yourself that now you've become part of the culture. You know, like people like, what is it? Oh God, I can't think of his name, but the guy who did Breitbart, you know what I mean? Like that's a guy who is a very, you know, he's that type of character. I can't even think of the word confrontational. It's polarizing, whatever. He's a very polarizing character because some people are like, look at what he's done. But at the end of the day, while he'll go and he'll say those things of, oh, this is, you know, what I'm against, he's also making a boatload of money off of that. And it's the same thing with these. I always look at like with news sources and stuff that are like, oh, we think that everybody, you know, we shouldn't get paid more. And then they're like, but also here's an article that you're definitely going to click on. So we get that ad revenue. That's exactly what Fight Club is doing, where it's saying to you all these things that you are against. If you stay against it long enough and people start to follow you, now you start to be that devil that you were against. And it's just so freaking interesting to me how this one is pulled off, because Edward Norton's character is so counterculture that he actually ends up becoming the culture that everybody wants to be. He can't even get away from it. He's in a freaking police unit and they're ready to kill him.
Yeah. But speaking of Edward Norton, what a perfect casting.
Oh yeah.
For the role of narrator, because he's just scrawny enough, but still well-built enough to like really capture this idea of like the Fight Club aspect of Fight Club. But the way he delivers his narration in this movie, he just perfectly encapsulates what Chuck Palahniuk is writing. Mm-hmm. And every single line he delivers when he makes a narration, when he's talking about being Jack's utter lack of surprise, mm-hmm. and just talking about his job as a recall analyst and everything like that, mm-hmm. it's just exactly the the feeling that is written on the page when you read Fight Club.
Yeah. I would say that this is one of the most true to the original work adaptations that I've ever seen adapted to screen. So I read this book in a day in high school, and there are lines in here that are pulled straight from the book, and a lot of it is pulled straight from the book. Like, there's a lot that is pulled straight from the book, because Polonyuk, he writes like he's doing a movie sometimes. And sometimes, like, you know, the problem is people try to copy his style, much like people try to do with really anything that becomes too popular. Again, like, Polonyuk. Thank you. Polonyuk is writing. I'm just going to start calling him Chuck. So Chuck is writing this. Clearly, he doesn't agree with consumerism. But then he makes a boatload of money off of this stuff, which is the ultimate irony of all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But he's writing this, and then people try to copy this style, and they don't understand the skill and the talent that goes into writing these lines. This isn't just, oh, I'm Jack's utter lack of self or utter lack of surprise. It's not that. Yeah, sure, anybody can write that, but can you make it have a meaning? Can you make it mean something where it's coming from these magazines and stuff? And I always think about Invisible Monsters because it's one of my favorite books, and how he's talking about, imagine this as a magazine and you're just flipping through because you don't have to read it all. And to give it that feeling of chaos the entire time is so hard to do, even though if you really look at a line here and there, it's not that impressive. It's not like your father couldn't come up with it. Like, it is something that they could, but can they put it all together and make it have meaning? And Fight Club is one of those where there's so many things that are, you know, you want to quote and you want to talk about, and yet, you know, it's not as simple as all that. There's so much depth to all of this that's going on.
Yeah, and Polonyuk is, he's pretty undisputably one of the greatest authors of the late 20th century, mm-hmm. and leading into the beginning part of the 21st century. And part of that comes down to the fact that he isn't using language that's really above and beyond anything. He does make a lot of his contact, or a lot of his text, is very colloquial and very easy to grasp, just reading it. So, and that translates again to Fight Club, and that's why Fight Club became so popular, is because it is, in all honesty, a very accessible movie that has everything you kind of look for in a movie. It has action sequences. It has romance plot that doesn't make sense but eventually does make sense. It has one of the greatest twist endings in cinema, probably, at this point.
Unfortunately, now so many people know it before they even watch the movie.
Yeah,
and the movie's too popular for its own good.
No, and that is one of the most unfortunate things, except for the fact that you get the Easter egg hunt all the way through the movie, where you're trying to figure out where you can figure out the twist. And one thing I noticed again, and I've noticed this before while watching it, Fight Club is one of those movies that actually kind of suffers from increasing definition.
That's a good point.
Because in the early scenes, there are three flashes of Tyler Durden. Mm-hmm. They are much more defined in high definition versions of this film than they are in lower definition versions of the film.
As is the porn shot at the very end.
Yes. That is a very distinct penis at the very end.
Yeah, it is there. That is in your face. And I think that's a good point. That's an interesting take there, because, you know, now with HD and people shooting in HD all the time, these pops and the grain, you know, me and my friends, we always talk about the grain, the House of the Devil, that movie. With the grain is there. You can see it's like the size of a nickel, all the little dots in this movie. But yeah, there is, like, I think old Fincher, Seven, this, Alien 3 is not old Fincher, but you know, these old Fincher movies, they almost do need to be watched on a VHS, where it's like, or on a film reel on a projector, you know, because that's what they were intended to be. They weren't intended to be this HD Tree of Life looking movie. It was meant to be a gritty, grimy movie that made you disgusted. Do some things work better? Sure. Maybe the scenes with Brad Pitt and Helena Bonham Carter doing whatever it is they do, kids. Maybe those scenes look better in this, because it's two of the most attractive people in Hollywood at the time. But still, think about how in focus all of that stuff is in the HD, and how not in focus it is when you are watching it in the older school, because it is more blurry, and now those blurred lines are starting to become a little bit more focused. intention for these kinds of things is very, very interesting. How that starts to shape up as you start to move away from, you know, older stuff.
Yeah, and I mean that also goes to show why Fincher is so. Fincher has a very good mastery of his of what he's doing and the format he's using, and intentionally builds his films for his format.
Yeah,
which is why this change in the amount of definition in the film does kind of impact it more, because you do, it's very clear. The first time Tyler pops up, you're like, wait, what was that? But the second time he pops up, you're like, oh, okay, that's what that is. And then he pops up a third time again a little later, which I actually had never noticed before until this watch.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
And it actually fits really tonally into the story, because it's actually, because the first times you see Tyler are before he starts going to the support groups. And then the third time isn't until Marla shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third time he pops up. So that's,
because it, that's shows the part Tyler's, of his, exactly, his mind coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
When his frustrations start to air, he becomes Tyler Durden.
So, I mean, let's not beat around the bush anymore. Obviously everyone knows the twist in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The narrator and Tyler Durden are the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator kind of pieces this together throughout, and then like eventually gets there when somebody happens to be like, Tyler Durden, that's you.
Yeah.
And then he goes on it, and we were talking about how faithful of an adaptation this is. There is one very big difference in the film than in the book, and that is the conclusion of them.
Mm.
To which Chuck Palahniuk has said, this is a better ending than what he wrote.
Yeah, because what is in the book, again, I haven't read it since high school, but what is the book?
He shoots himself in the head, and then he wakes up in the hospital.
Yes.
And it's very clear that Project Mayhem's still going on.
Yes.
Despite what he's done.
Yes.
Whereas, this has to be one of the most prolific endings in all.
Fantastic ending.
You just get, you met me at a real strange time in my life, and then Pixies just blares, and it's such a perfect ending for this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's because it doesn't break the chaos. Otherwise, it kind of feels like a Clockwork Orange, you know, where it's, oh, now he's in the hospital, you know, and it doesn't need to happen. I forgot about that, but it's so true, because the ending is one of the most popular parts of the movie. I mean, the last 20 minutes movie, I mean, that's what really brings people. I mean, obviously there's great, his name is Robert Paulson, and and you know, like the Marla Singer stuff is great. The addiction stuff at the beginning is great. The plane crashing into the other plane. I mean, all of those things, but it is this last 20 minutes when you find out who Tyler Durden really is. And when those buildings are exploding, that last shot of them holding hands, like they're two cartoon characters. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's perfect.
Yeah. And the fact that the movie also opens at the end of the film too. And it's like, how are we in this spot? And how did we get here? And then it's like going through it all. And we even see the narrator go back further in the story. Because he initially starts with him, with Bob being in Bob's bitch tits. And then he's like, no, wait, we have to go back further. And it just feels so natural as a storytelling that way. Because it doesn't feel like it's just perfectly contrived all the way through. It feels like this is actually someone telling you what has happened.
Yeah, and if you notice throughout the movie too, there's things that take place out of order, or you know, like there'll be like little flashes of stuff. You wake up here, you wake up here, you wake up here, you wake up here, which also is pulled straight from the book, all those you wake up here's. And then he finally gets to the Tyler part. Those other things probably happened earlier when he goes to the burned out carcass of the car. That might have happened earlier. Like, we don't really know when all this stuff was happening. And I think it kind of gets into the chaos of narrator's brain, of just of, like, where am I kind of right now? And, you know, the part that always gets me, because to me, it's like when it becomes the most obvious, is when he says, you know, it reminded me of my first fight with Tyler, when he's punching himself in the face in the boss's office. I'm like, that's the point where you really do pick up on it. But yeah, there's a lot of just like chaotic moments in this that help you feel like you're in Edward Norton's brain the entire time, because it is his movie. Even though Tyler Durden is the one everybody remembers, this is Ed Norton's movie.
Yeah, because Ed Norton is Tyler Durden. They're the same person.
Yeah.
And have you ever noticed the most obvious tell at the beginning of the movie that Tyler Durden doesn't exist?
I don't, I'm willing to hear.
when he shows up at his apartment and it's been blown up, and he's at the payphone, the payphone says no incoming calls.
Really?
It does. So, like, there are hints throughout this entire movie that Tyler Durden does not exist.
Yeah.
He has the same briefcase. No incoming calls. And the fact that Tyler and Marla are never in the same room together and things like that. The fact that Tyler starts speaking for him. It's the best thing about this twist, and the thing that makes a real good twist, it has to be prefaced throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back to Survivor. We had a conversation in the patron group this week about Samoa and how the twist that Natalie White wins Samoa isn't properly set up because the expectation is that Russell gets there. And that's what makes it a bad twist.
Yeah.
But in Fight Club, you are told from the very beginning, if you're paying enough attention, that this twist is coming.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you think about it, this was popular for the time for these types of twist endings, because Usual Suspects had come out just 4 years prior, or it's 3 years prior.
1999, one of the biggest twist endings of all time also came out that year.
Yeah, The Sixth Sense comes out. Exactly. That's The Sixth Sense, everybody. So, yeah, I mean, you have movies like that where this was the popular thing in the 90s, and then it started to be done to death in the 2000s, and it started to lose its meaning because people didn't realize. And you know, writers, maybe writers, producers, it goes right down the line, but they didn't realize what made those twists so meaningful is that it was right in front of you the whole time. It was right in front of you, literally the entire movie. Now, a movie like Seven can get away with the twist of John Doe being who John Doe is. And I won't talk about that because we're gonna be talking about that movie at some point, but John Doe being who John Doe is because the movie set up for it to be kind of out of left field. But The Usual Suspects, Kaiser Soze, has to be meaningful. And in this movie, this Tyler Durden twist has to be meaningful. And in The Sixth Sense, that has to be meaningful. And again, you see it the whole time. You just don't realize. The Others, which I know is on your list, which we'll be talking about, phenomenal ending to that movie. And it's because it makes sense the whole time. When it's lazy and it's like, haha, here's your twist for your twist, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. It's not satisfying. And the best twist endings feel more satisfying because they leave you going, oh my God, did you see that coming? But a bad twist ending leads you going, ugh, where was that? I didn't see that coming because that doesn't even make sense. Like, what is going on here? And so, yeah, I think that this movie does it really, really well because there are so many hints throughout the movie that when you watch it on like the 50th time, like we all are now, you know exactly what's happening. You're saying to yourself, how did I not notice the first time?
But it's still so enjoyable because you're still looking for them and you're looking for them. That a good twist movie shouldn't be ruined by you knowing the twist.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And there's a lot of movies like that. There's a lot of movies where the first time you watch it, you'll be like, oh, that was good. And then you watch it the next time. You're like, how about that? Oh, so that wasn't good. You know, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So yeah, Psycho, one of those movies where it's just like perfect from start to finish because you're just like, where the hell did that come from? But also it makes sense. There's so many hints throughout and you got to go the Hitchcock style. You got to go the Hitchcock style. Otherwise you're probably going to make a movie with a really crappy ending. And if you look at a lot of horror movies nowadays, what's funny is other than Psycho and The Sixth Sense, but when you start to look at some of these movies with the twist endings, they're not even horror movies. You know, Usual Suspects isn't a horror movie. Fight Club's not a horror movie. And now it seems like all horror movies are just like, how can we throw in a twist at the end? What if they're a ghost? What if they're this? What if they're that? What if they're the, you know, whatever? And it's like, stop. It's been done now. You got to come up with something new. I mean, what's amazing is that when The Sixth Sense did what it did, that was the first time. When The Others does what it does, it's kind of the first time. Mm-hmm. That's why it works.
Yeah, exactly. And mix that in with the messages Polonick put into the book, and Fincher perfectly capturing them in this film, even to the point where it's like, we're talking about the consumerism, and then all of a sudden, I think the one point where you realize the consumerism is leaking over into the toxic masculinity of it all is the point where the narrator's like, and now we have corporate sponsorship.
Yeah. Exactly. And another thing that I think this movie has a theme of, which I found to be very relevant right now because of COVID and all of that, is this theme of having a purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think that having a purpose, especially, and this is a man movie, you know, men doing men things and beating each other up and all of that, and Helena Bonham Carter being the manic pixie dream girl and all of those things. Like, this is very much leaning into the tropes purposefully and doing that. But there's this whole stigma of like, a man's not a man if they don't have this purpose, if they don't provide, if they don't do that. And that's why, you know, when we see at the beginning, when he's at the testicular cancer, anonymous, and oh, we don't have our balls anymore, so we're not men and all of that. But this movie is showing that just because you have a purpose doesn't necessarily mean your purpose is worthwhile. Your purpose could be very bad, but there's a desperation sometimes when you start to hit a certain point in your life and you feel like your life has no purpose, that you start to say to yourself, okay, well, I'm getting desperate. What can I do to make my life have some sort of meaning? How can I have a meaning in my life? And okay, I'm going to join a cult, essentially. I'm going to beat the crap out of people, and we're going to go live in this falling apart house on Paper Street, and we're going to just start to make soap. Like, we're literally a cult, and then we're going to blow things up. And that desperation, especially right now, where a lot of people are struggling because they've lost jobs, they've lost homes, they've lost loved ones, they've lost all this stuff, and they're starting to have to re-identify themselves. That desperation for purpose is just so relevant, really, at any time, but especially now, that I just found it to be really powerful this time. And you know, ultimately, that's what Edward Norton's looking for. He's tired of his job. He's tired of his life. He wants to have a bigger purpose than that. And that's why he starts going to the anonymous meetings, because he's looking for a way to make himself more relevant to society. Because, hey, if you tell somebody you're dying, they really listen to you.
That was that line by Marla, and that interaction between Marla and the narrator, when it's like they really listen. And Marla's like, instead of waiting for their next, like for their next time to speak, I'm like, wow, that is a powerful line.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time when you are having a conversation with people, it does feel like they're just waiting for their next chance to speak rather than to actually just listen to what you're saying.
Which is literally what we do on this podcast. I listen, but we also are waiting for our next chance to speak, so we can't quite digest it as quickly. But yeah, no, it's a great point. And that's something that people still have a hard time with now. I mean, it's even like, why do you send out a tweet? You send out a tweet in hopes that somebody will tweet back so you can tweet back. So like, you can say something else. Like, you just want to get your 140 characters in, and can I get another 140 in? Ooh, maybe I'll get another 140. Like, that's, it's crazy. It's like a sickness. And you know, what, again, going to this whole theme of also becoming the monster that you're so anti, what I love about this movie is Marla and narrator become addicted to addiction anonymous situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously testicular cancer isn't an addiction thing, but with the Alcoholics Anonymous, and they start becoming addicted to like the illness ones and all that. Now they're addicted to something that's supposed to be helping people either overcome addictions or overcome depression or overcome these massive moments in life. And they're becoming addicted to those things. And it's just funny how, like, you know, at the same point, like, you always hear about these people who they'll go to drug rehab, they come out of drug rehab, and all of a sudden they're back on drugs because they start to like miss the rehab. They kind of, that was like their life now. And that was what kind of gave them, again, purpose and meaning and all of that. And it's sad, but it's something that's still relevant 22 years later.
Yeah. And that's one of the big things with this film, is that it still does hold up 22 years later. I mean, the novel was written, I think, in 94 was when it was first released. And the fact that these themes are still so prevalent in today's world is astounding. And I wrote it on Letterboxd today. If more people watched Fight Club and actually understood the themes of it, the world would be a better place.
Well, and I think Polonick is so ahead of his time, because I say the same thing, Invisible Monsters, which I think is probably his best book. And it's either that or Haunted, in my opinion. But he's got four, I think you can make the argument for, which is Fight Club, Haunted, Invisible Monsters, and Choke. I'd say those are pretty much like the four you can really make the argument for as his best work. All of them are ahead of their time. Every single one of them. And the Choke movie sucked. I mean, Sam Rockwell's performance is fine, but the movie just doesn't do the book justice. They just kind of missed the point of what it was. But if you look at what Invisible Monsters is about, Invisible Monsters is about a woman who had half of her face shot off, and now she was a model who now has to hide her face because she's too ugly, and she's going on a journey with a transgender person, and they're just traveling around the world. Where are they going to go next? We're on a road trip. And it's these things that are just so far ahead of their time, because it's set in the 90s, but it's not done tastelessly. It's done very much in the realm of like the struggles that that people are dealing with when they're viewed as not normal and not okay. And Haunted is the same way. Every single one of those characters has an issue of some sort. And then Choke, this whole idea of people are going to feel bad for me and they're going to give me money because they have a savior complex. They're all such mirrors to reality and mirrors to society. And they all still hold up. It's like they're it's almost like they were written at a time when they weren't properly appreciated because people didn't realize where we were quite going. And it's why, you know, Paul and Nick kind of gets disregarded sometimes in some of the bigger
literary circles.
Yeah. The bigger literary circles. Cause he's mainstream fodder, but he's not like Stephen King, where, you know, my friends keep sending a line from The Dead Zone where it says, "Let's face it, gang, she was damn sexy," or something like that. And it's like, he actually wrote that in a book, and like he made millions of dollars off of that book. But Palahniuk doesn't do that. No. He just gets his point across, and it's very succinct and it's very purposeful. And he's ahead of his time in a lot of facets. And Fight Club, I mean, it's still relevant today with people just like, you know, people want to destroy things right now. I mean, that's something that people are very angry, and they feel like they're starting to lose control and they want to take control back.
Yeah. And I mean, Fight Club's going to be one of those eternal stories, I think, just because, like I mentioned at the top of this segment, somebody always comes up and says, "Hey, have you seen Fight Club?" Mm-hmm. And in every high school across North America, some grade 11 or 12 student will come along and talk to some ninth grader and be like, "Hey, have you seen Fight Club?" And it'll always get passed down from generation to generation.
Yep. It's true. It's true. And you know what? This is the type of movie you say if your kid hasn't seen it at 14 or 15 when they're starting high school or something, and you're a dad, you're like, "Hey, you want to watch Fight Club?" Like, that's a movie you throw on. Yeah. I mean, that's a movie you throw on. And look, nowadays, I mean, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but nowadays people are watching these movies at 13, 14. And guess what? I was watching these movies at 13, 14, too. And I'm okay.
So was I.
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm not going to lie to you. I was probably watching these movies at 10, 11, 12. Like, I don't know what the hell was going on, but it was what it was. I put my head down when the sex scenes happened. That's what happened. You know what I like? It's just crazy. And you know, in terms of the violence and stuff, I saw Gladiator in theaters.
So did I.
I know. So it's like, you know, you make your own damn choices. And I don't know. I agree with you. I think Fight Club is just one of those movies. Like, I ever have a son, it's like, "We're watching Fight Club tonight. Dad, I don't want to watch one of your old stupid movies. Shut up and watch Fight Club." Like, that's just what it's going to be.
Also, so I broke out my 10th anniversary Blu-ray to watch it this time. Mm-hmm. That Blu-ray trolls you.
Really?
You put it in. The startup menu is "Never Been Kissed."
Oh my God, that's funny.
So you put the disc into your player and it starts going, and then "Never Been Kissed" comes up, and you're freaking out because you're like, this isn't Fight Club. This is like the opposite of Fight Club. Mm-hmm. And then, like, after about 30 seconds or so, it switches over to
that's
the
Fight amazing. Club. Yeah, I have a version that I borrowed from my friend back in like 2005, 2006. It's still here. Espo, if you want it, call me up, man. I'll bring it back to you. But I borrowed it from him, and I just never gave it back because I wanted to watch it. And he clearly doesn't miss it because I've had it for 15 years now. But what are you going to do? Anyway, fun discussion about Fight Club. I think Fight Club is one of those movies that is fun to discuss. It's fun to dissect. It's also just fun to watch. And I think sometimes movies – see, like, I'm not big into like a Shane Carruth or something like that, where it's like, "No, but think about all the messages and themes and how heavy." And I'm like, but it's not fun for me to watch. And Fight Club is one of those movies that is fun to watch and also fun to break down and get into the depths of. And that's what sets it apart from a lot of other movies of the similar genre. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's in the hands of one of the great directors of all time. And it has two of the best actors of their generation. And I would argue that Brad Pitt's one of the best actors ever. Although people would probably laugh at me, but you go tell me, you know, after watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Tree of Life, name a better performance as a grumpy old dad than Brad Pitt in Tree of Life. It's very hard to do. And he got no credit cause he's just too damn pretty. But you know, you have those two, and then Helena Bonham Carter, who's just, I mean, as soon as Tim Burton saw this movie, is like, he called up his agent. He said, "Get me your number." I mean, that had to be how it went down, because that was everything Tim Burton had ever wanted in his life. And I think they had met before this, but you know, it's just one of those things where she's pulled straight out of a Tim Burton movie. But that's why this movie works. And gritty Fincher is the best kind of Fincher. Cause even I would even classify Social Network as gritty.
Yeah.
And gritty Fincher is the best Fincher.
I think I have 4 Fincher movies on my top 100.
I have
5. Fincher movies on my top 100.
This, 7, Social Network, and what are the other two?
I have Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I have Zodiac on my list.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Zodiac's a good one. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, we've kind of discussed a little bit. At least you didn't say Ben Button, because, yikes. No, Ben Button has a phenomenal scene, and that's about it.
But, no, Greedy Fincher is good, and Fight Club just kind of is so accessible for Fincher. Mm-hmm. And we get to talk about it, despite the fact that we're not supposed to.
Yeah.
And it's been really fun tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that was our conversation about Cabaret and Fight Club, number 89 on both of our lists. If you're enjoying these, make sure to spread the word. I mean, Fight Club is a pretty popular movie. We did Up last week. So, you know, as we start doing some of these more popular movies, if you know anybody who wants to listen to this, start spreading the word, get them involved. We're getting pretty good listens for sure on iTunes and everything. So I'm not complaining. Our YouTube might not look great, but our iTunes and our Spotify is doing really, really well. So that's why we keep on turning these things out. And because we just like talking about movies, the Oscars are going to be in 2 weeks, and John and I are actually planning to do a Oscar type show beforehand. Probably going to be happening pretty close, though, maybe like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday or something like that before the Oscars. Yeah. We're going to discuss that, but that's definitely something that we're talking about doing because that is coming up, and that is just something that we'll have to talk about. I'm still two movies short. I haven't seen Sound of Metal or Trial of Chicago 7, and then I barely seen anything that any of the women nominated for Best Actress are in. But seen all the other stuff, and I did watch Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and I actually quite liked Chadwick Boseman in that. I thought it was a very good, very good performance. So we will discuss that. But next week, number 88 is what we're moving on to. John's movie is Annihilation from 2018. I can't believe that's only how old it is. I feel like that movie's been around for so much longer. Yikes. I don't know, man. Maybe it's just because it hit and then I stopped working and went back to grad school, and then COVID hit, but that movie feels like it's been around for a decade. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna be talking about Atonement, which has been around for longer than a decade, and I cannot believe that those two movies are 11 years apart. That's wild. Yeah. But Atonement, yes, everybody, hang on, let me make sure I say this correctly, because I want to really irk John here, but Atonement, oh, it's not. I was going to say my highest rated movie from 2007, but that actually goes to The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which isn't much higher. So that should irk some There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men fans.
Yep. Just a little.
John, I'm looking at that. Yeah, you have There Will Be Blood a little high on your list. But anyway,
a little higher.
A little bit, but we'll be talking about Annihilation and Atonement. At least these two movies have something in common, and that's that they both start with the letter A. That's about it, though. And Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley are both in them. And guess what? Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley were Padme or whatever the hell. They were the Queen Amidala in The Phantom Menace. So we can talk all about that as a connection next week as we start to break these movies down. But that should be a fun one. Two very different movies. Once again, a sci-fi movie by Alex Garland, and then a Joe Wright romantic period piece that another one with quite an ending. Let's just put it that way. If you haven't seen the movie, it's another one where the ending satisfies because it is what it is. And Joe Wright, I think this is his finest work, and just showed off his talent and what he can do when there's not too much interference from a studio. But anyway, all that being said, we've gone on too long already. John, J. Millsip at Letterboxd. I'm P. Wood, 43 on Letterboxd. We'll see you next time, next week, talking about our number 8, Annihilation and Atonement. Get out there and watch it. Get ready for tears and get ready for some shock. That's all I'll say about those two.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and 4-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Oh, O'Reilly. Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.